Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. This is part two of a really impactful, just amazing episode series that I'm just so pleased to be able to do. This is with Dan Brown, and he's the author of 24 books. He's actually studied molecular biology, religion, psychology, and he's been on the faculty of Harvard for 40 years as an associate clinical professor of psychology, and he teaches hypnotherapy and has for many years, along with multiple languages, Buddhist meditation master, translated original texts, and one of the most amazing people that you've probably heard on the show, as well as just a master of how we get to be who we are and things that are going on that we don't know about. These are the things that are likely to stop you from being bulletproof, but they're things you might not even see until someone shines a light on them for you. And Dan has spent a lot of his life creating that kind of light. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. Pleasure to be here.
We're going to talk in this episode about some of the things we just couldn't fit in the first episode. And you talk about relational maps, about the ways people connect with each other. I want to go deeper with you on that. What is a relational map? What is a relational map?
There are two relational maps that develop. The first one develops around 18 months, which is prior to the most of the development of narrative memory. So it's called an attachment map. And there are four types of attachment. Secure attachment is an interplay between healthy attachment to the caregiver, and the more the paradox of human attachment is, the more secure you feel in the attachment relationship, the more you become independent and explore the world. So the more secure you are, not the less secure you are, the more you become independent and explore the world. That's called secure attachment. There are three versions of insecure attachment that can also develop. One is where the attachment system is taken offline, and that's called dismissing attachment in adults. And they don't do relationships. They might stay in a relationship, but they don't talk about themselves. They don't bring their feelings into the relationship. They can't be real in a relationship. They stay remarkably distant even if they're in a relationship. So they deactivate the attachment system and they become sort of pseudo-independent in life. So it's sort of exaggerated exploratory behavior, but not in the context of healthy attachment. What they can't do is explore in the context of relationships. The opposite, the mirror opposite of that, is somebody with anxious, preoccupied attachment. And they have a weak sense of self, and they get over-involved in the state of mind of the other. So they become chronic compulsive caretakers in relationships at the expense of themselves.
Codependent types of people?
Yeah, they get very clingy in relationships. Yeah. So what they have is weak sense of self-development. So they've deactivated the exploratory system, and they get over-involved in the attachment system. They get very clingy in relationships and very jealous, and they can't let go of the relationship. What's missing is they can't grow. They can't develop the sense of self in the context of a close relationship. So they've deactivated the exploratory system. The third type of insecure attachment is they've deactivated both the exploratory system and the attachment system. And that's what you see with mostly people who have traumatic attachment. So the impossible dilemma for them is that the source of attachment is also the source of fear and terror. So they can't ever get soothed in the relationship. So they expect to be hyper-vigilant and fearful of the attachment relationship, so they can never settle into the relationship and develop a sense of self. Those maps are in place by about 18 months.
Wow.
But that's prior to when we get to know the insight into them. So that they're prior to what we call a narrative memory, but they're what we call an active memory. We live them in our relationships in one of those four types. And once that map develops, the chances are it's very stable. We have 40-year prospective studies showing that these maps, three or four of these maps, will stay the same for over 40 years without changing them. So if you have a dysfunctional, insecure attachment, the likelihood is you're going to play that out one after the other in every relationship you're in. Then there's a second map that comes up later. This happens in the third and fourth year of life. We can take in much more complex messages and emotional ideas and develop limiting core beliefs about what's possible and what isn't possible in relationships. And that's called the CCRT map, the core conflict relational theme map. So the way that works is you take a history of all intimate relationships in a person's life. So maybe they have 15 intimate relationships in the course of their life. And you read it like, you step back and read it like a musical score. And what you see is that all over the map, there's one or two central themes infinite variations on the same two themes. And so it affects how we select relationships. We select relationships wanting something, and rather than getting that, instead we create the same core conflict over and over again. It's either one or two patterns usually. And so there are two types of relationship dysfunction: attachment maps and core conflict relationship maps. And the simple way of putting that is the difficulty with relationships or difficulty within relationships. So okay. If people have an attachment problem, that supersedes the other problem because they don't connect easily. But once they connect, even if they have secure attachment, the likelihood is very high. You're going to keep selecting for the same old time, dysfunctional relationship one after the other. The relationship is purposeful. We select unconsciously to play out the same old conflict over and over again rather than working it out. So in therapy, you want to build a new map. You want to build a new attachment map or a core conflict relationship map, a positive map. The person can make that as the basis of operation and operate out of that positive map. And that's what we do in psychotherapy around relationship disturbances. There's two main types of relationship disturbances: either attachment disturbance or core conflict relationship disturbance.
What is the fastest way, typically, I know it can be individual, for someone to create a new map?
We call it positive remapping.
Okay.
So I differ from most of my Western psychology conflicts where I have a background in Buddhism. And in Buddhist Abhidharma, the theory of mind, it says that the techniques to work with positive states and the techniques to work with negative states are not reducible to each other. So if we work with techniques to work with negative states and we're successful with that, we get a relative reduction of it, maybe even absence of negative states. But the absence of a negative is not a positive. So much of emphasis in the Western psychology is on trying to develop, looking at the dysfunctional maps. And if even we do that, we can reduce the noise in the system, but that doesn't make a positive map. So what we did is move in a totally different direction. We have them visualize ideal parents if they have an attachment problem, if they have a disorganized attachment or anxious, preoccupied attachment or dismissing attachment, having developed ideal parents that they do all the right things in attachment. If they do that visualization over and over again, once a week in a session and maybe every day on their own, because we make a recording of the session, they practice it, because then you got to practice things learning. There's learning to practice it, to practice it many times. If they do that over and over again, between 6 months and 2 years later, they've made a new relationship map, positive map, and it's stable. And they begin to make that the basis of operation, and then whatever dysfunctional patterns are just irrelevant. They don't go there anymore because the feedback from the positive state works much better.
Wow. So it can be done pretty quickly.
Yes, and the research on core conflict relationship theme map shows that you change it in about 30 to 50 hours. It's the average time it takes.
All right, 50 hours is doable. There's kind of a reputation in the West. People say, I sat on a couch once a week for 20 years and not that much changed, but I felt better for a little while each week. And is that a problem with techniques?
It's a problem with techniques. I did that. I spent 9 years on the couch 4 times a week. It's a problem with techniques. I did that. I spent 9 years on the couch 4 times a week. And by the 8th year, I just said, I can't go on. This is too expensive and too much time. So yeah. I told my analyst I was going to stop in another year. And she didn't take that seriously at first. And then she began to take it seriously. And then she began to use all the things she'd taken notes on all the years, explain it to me. And I said, well, why don't you do this earlier? This would have been much more useful. We did finish another year.
Is there an inherent conflict of interest when you pay someone per hour to help you get better?
No.
No?
Okay. I don't think so.
I don't feel like any healer I've ever met would ever consciously say, oh, I'm going to slow down your healing to make more money. But I've heard people say that. And I think it takes a lot of work and desire to become a therapist. It's actually hard work, even just to do your own therapy, to become a therapist. So I don't think that's a real issue. But man, I sure hear people talk about it. So
yeah, but the better therapists don't do that. I've done therapy for 50 years now.
Yeah.
So now what's important for me is that there's a clear vision I have of where the person needs to get to, and I don't waste any time getting them there. So I move them along the map, because as soon as they get better and they get on with their life, it's better for me and better for them.
Yeah. And plus, you like to help people. Wouldn't you like to help more people, not less people?
Yeah, that's true.
So I agree with you. That makes good sense. I just wanted to ask that on behalf of listeners who've asked me the same thing. When you talk about being your best self, which is also a little bit different than some of the therapeutic, let's fix what's wrong with you perspectives, you've done a pretty incredible amount of work there. So what does it take in order to be your best self?
I trained in the 1970s and 80s, and I was at the University of Chicago in the 1970s, and my mentor was Erica Fromm, the great hypnoanalyst. I worked with her for 36 years. She died when she was 92.
Wow.
She had a long relationship. She was my main clinical mentor. And she did very short-term focus work with visualizations and hypnosis and got people better in short periods of time. But then when I did my first clinical placement at Michael Reese Hospital in the Big South Side Hospital in Chicago, my clinical supervisor was Heinz Kohut, the pioneer who developed self-psychology.
Wow.
He came from an analytic background, and I spent 9 years on the couch with a self-psychological analyst. It takes forever to do that work. But then I was left with putting together two worlds, the short-term world of visualizations with hypnosis and the long-term world of self-development. And at some point, I tried to forge the bridge between those two worlds. And I read something in about self-esteem development. It came from Joe Sandler at the Hampstead Clinic in London. And he said that self-esteem is the developmental linkage of positive emotions to the self-representation. That's a developmental outcome. What does it mean? It means that when we develop a healthy sense of self-esteem, if I conjure up a sense of dandness during the day, or you conjure up a sense of Davidness, if you have healthy esteem, you conjure up against the backdrop of your positive feelings. But if I never develop the healthy self-esteem, when I conjure up that sense of self, I conjure up against the backdrop of no feelings. Or I conjure up against the backdrop of logic negative feelings. But what I can't do is conjure up against the backdrop of positive feelings. That's what's missing. So where does that come from developmentally? I began to look into that. And it came from what we call one of the five great functions of attachment, which is what I call express delight. Healthy parents are totally effusive all of the time about everything that their kid does. It's a positive sense of joy for them and delight. But they're not only delighted about the child, whatever thing the child does, they're delighted about the child's being. And they're constantly effusive about that. And that gets internalized. So the child figures out at some point that all that positivity is about themselves and itself. And that forces that link. But the reason why chronic self-esteem failure, which we call narcissism in the West, is such an epidemic in the West, is that we don't do that because parents are too busy. So they involve themselves in the job of parenting, but not the joy of parenting. That's what's missing in this culture. And that's why narcissism is such a rampant disease in Western culture.
What's the fix for that?
We began to think about how to link our positive emotions to the self, a sense of self. We did that first with us just focusing on self-development, and then focusing on self-development in the context of attachment. And what we began to say is, if I say to you, bring to mind a scene where you feel really good about yourself, especially good about yourself, and have you imagine that scene now, you can do that. You're associated with some activity. You're doing something, and as long as you're doing that, you can feel good about yourself. You can generate the feeling, and you can generate the feeling with some intensity, and you can hold it for some period of time. So I have you do that many times over and practice it during the week. So you're actually intentionally generating positive feelings that is directly associated with the self. That's how specific the protocol is. Once you can do that readily, then we'd have you to focus on generating a good feeling about yourself in the context of relationship. That's harder. And hold that. A third is what we call skill development. Generate that sense of self, the positive sense of self, more quickly, more frequently, for longer duration, more immediately, frequently and for longer duration. And the task is you have to keep generating it over and over again, and hold it for longer periods of time. Then we give you homework assignments to generate it during the day and see how long you can hold it for. And keep a journal of how long of the day you can hold it for. And at some point, you hold it more than day than not. And everything shifts at that point. They're holding a good sense of themselves most of the time. Not all of the time, but most of the time. And then we look at the times that they can't hold a good feeling about themselves. And we have them, rather than analyzing that and saying these are the negative patterns, we positively wrap right over those patterns. We say, okay, now put yourself in a situation where you normally don't feel good about yourself and hold a good sense of yourself and see how long you can hold it for in that situation. So the demand becomes to hold it in situations that they're less likely to hold it in. And the last part of the protocol is what we call shifting from doing to being. Holding a good feeling about yourself just in who you are rather than having to do anything to get it. Once they get that, and they can hold it most of the time, they've repaired the esteem. It takes about 6 months to 2 years to work out that protocol. But if what we're talking about is repairing chronic self-esteem failure in that period of time, that's worth it.
6 months to 2 years, and you're doing, 1 hour a week of working with a therapist?
Yeah, 1 hour a week, and then after a while, we cut it down to once a month.
Okay.
They do the visualization more on their own, so they get the sense of that they're doing it rather than I'm doing something to them.
So it's a dedicated practice that someone chooses to do. And I've had friends who've gone through this, and you see a massive shift, even in the first few months. But by the time it's done, their ability to have relationships is very different than it was before. And they seem much happier than people who maybe haven't focused on that kind of a path, and they're sort of saying, yeah, I go to a therapist for sometimes, but it seems like there isn't that training that happens outside of the room. And what you're doing there is really teaching awareness. It sounds almost Buddhist. what's your mind doing right now? What's your mind doing right now?
Yeah, but it's not more specific than just to being aware of it.
We're changing a positive map.
That's what's unique about these protocols.
Wow. How would someone go about finding a therapist capable of doing what you just talked about?
We have a website called the Attachment Project.
Okay.
If you go on the Attachment Project, there's a relationship quiz. It's actually a self-report quiz that's widely used in the clinical field. It's called the Experience of Close Relationships. And they can take it and get a self-score. It's a much more accurate version than self-report, because sometimes self-reports are accurate. People have believed themselves to be securely attached, and they're really not.
Mm.
So the best way of doing it is what we call the adult attachment inventory. And that takes about 2 hours to administer and score. You need somebody who's trained and certified in that. But I do that a lot on this website. I like doing it. I've done over 1,000 of them, scored over 1,000 of them now.
Wow.
So
it's something, if you're listening to the show and you're saying, all right, I don't have the best relationships, you might want to work on hacking that and getting the data, knowing what's going on. And for me, understanding that the stuff that happens in the first 18 months, and then again at age 3 to 4, that is such a big explanatory factor for why you may think the things you think or feel the things you feel about yourself. I picked this up when I was about 30. I learned that, and I actually started crying at the time, because it was one of those things where, like, it wasn't my fault. Right? I had a lot of negative self-talk, and you realize, okay, it's changeable. So you're listening to this going, I've mastered my physical body, and I'm doing the bulletproof diet, and I'm doing my breathing exercises. All of those are good things. But if this stuff is there, it's not like you chose these things. It's that they're in there. But knowing that it's changeable, and it's not 25 years of suffering changeable, but it's changeable in a year or two, I find it pretty liberating. And Dan, I think you're one of the masters of getting in and what's really going on in there and mapping this out.
Well, in the last 20 years, there's been a movement in positive psychology. I happen to think that positive states are far more important for mental health than negative states. But the field has come from focusing entirely on negative states, and I don't think that's useful.
It's kind of built into our society. You look at Google, their original tagline was, don't be evil. But they could have also just said, be good. One of those is positive and one of those is negative. Right. And I like the be good side of things.
I agree with you. You focus on a positive map, and then that, you get feedback that that's working for you. You don't go back to the negative map because it doesn't work as well.
Okay, here we go. Is there a visualization or some type of exercise that people could actually hear on the show today?
Let's just say more things about the sense of self before we do the visualization.
Okay, then let's talk some more about the sense of self.
There's a line of self-development. It starts with self-definition, knowing who you are, knowing what qualities represent the best self. Then the next thing is what's called self-agency. That means you feel like you have an impact on the environment around you, the world around you, in general. And then more specifically, that you have an impact on the relationships with others. You're actually listening to the kind of responses you want in the relationships with others. So that's called self-agency. And the third is self-esteem, feeling good about yourself. So if we look at those three as developmental steps in the variant sequence. So the first would be knowing who you are. Second would be knowing who you're about, what you're about. The third would be feeling good about yourself. And those are separate developmental levels. So if we have somebody with a significant lack of self-development, or also significant self-pathology, we have to find out where they are on the map. Some people, they have a sense of, they lack self-esteem, but they have a good sense of agency and a good sense of self-definition. And what they'll do is they'll use agency to compensate for the fact they don't have any esteem. So they're always having to do new things to accomplish things. They have a hold a good feeling about themselves and just in their being. We see a lot of people like that. They're very successful in what they do. They can never feel good about themselves.
So you can be really insecure, don't feel good about yourself, so you want to prove things to others. So you go out and you become very successful in the world because you're sort of fighting against that internal feeling you have.
You're always troubling yourself up, pun intended.
I see that a lot. A lot of entrepreneurs, I think, have that. That I'm going to go out and prove to the world that I'm
right.
Better than I think I am.
But they don't hold a good sense of themselves in their being. We say they have chronic self-esteem failure. They're always having to do, so they're unhappy because they're always having to do something new. they're only successful to the extent that they're successful in the current project. But they can't just feel good about themselves and hold that as a backdrop of their positive feeling all the time. That's what's missing.
Yep.
So they're never self-content. They rarely feel good about themselves.
Yeah, it's rough too, because once you get on that path, if you're doing a whole bunch of work things, when are you going to find the time to do the work on yourself? And that tends to be the work that gets deprecated. Right. So then you never get out of that trap because you're just too busy to pay attention to yourself.
And then there are people who have largely self-agency failures, and they don't be successful in love and work. They don't get together and do things that have made an impact on the world around them. And then we have people that lack self-definition, and they don't even know who they are. They never developed a sense of self, and a strong sense of self in any way. Just lost. So those are the three failures: failure of self-definition, failure of self-agency, or failure of self-esteem.
What causes each of those failures? Is there an age, or is there an experience? Why is this happening to us?
Because it has to do with attachment.
It's all about attachment. Okay.
There are five great functions of attachment. We talked a little about that last time. Safety and protection is the first. Careful attunement to one's behavior and one's state of mind is the second. Comforting, verbal reassurance, and physical connection when they're feeling upset, emotionally upset. The fourth and the fifth are the ones that are relative to the sense of self. The fourth is expressed delight, which is related to self-esteem development. And the fifth is that the best children who are healthy attached, the parents bring out the best of their self-development. They're the champions of the sense of self in the child. They know how to foster the right conditions for the child to explore and to discover and make their own mistakes and discover who they are. The opposite of that is a parent who have agendas for the child. They decide who the child is supposed to be to meet their needs. What Alice Miller called the giant drama of the gifted child. So you have to grow up to fulfill your parents' needs, and you never develop your own sense of self independent of them. So we have a lot of people out there who have needs to have their kids turn out to be a certain way. So that's what causes a failure to self-development. Or we have parents who let the children explore, but they're too busy to get involved in that. So the kids grow up with a lack of esteem and always having to do things to prove themselves to the parents and to everybody else. So it's a failure of attachment, ultimately.
Wow. So either you got to explore, but you didn't have a parent exploring with you, which is going to create a problem, or you didn't get to explore because you were already on a path.
But the message I want to give is these things are all very fixable. We can be very precise in terms of what's wrong, and what we pitch the visualizations, and we can correct them.
That's why this interview had me so excited, why I wanted to be on again. It is fixable, and it's fixable in a reasonably short period of time, so that if any of those three descriptions fits you listening to the show, look, it's sort of like I have a problem with my shoulder. You'd go to a physical therapist and you fix the problem with your shoulder. This is a similar type of healing where it's diagnosable, it's quantifiable, and you do the work and you get better versus just living with the pain or the suffering all the time. And it's big work, man. You change enough people who don't act this way, it changes all of society. It's a really big thing.
But you see, we come from a tradition in psychotherapy where most therapists don't get the training. We have 50 years of good outcomes research. That's what did Harvard Medical School, and it's continued education for the last 30 years. So I get actually paid to read all the outcome journals. So almost every diagnostic category, we know exactly what to do. Maybe the exception of schizophrenia, we know exactly what every other psychiatric diagnosis that we have, we know exactly what to do with these patients. And we can get them there. But most people go into therapy and never read any of the literature. They just say, we'll just talk about feelings. And they think that's therapy.
I'm so happy you're saying that so I don't have to, because you have the credentials to say that credibly. But it is exactly what my observation over my much shorter life has been, is that talking about your feelings probably isn't going to solve them if they're not doing what you want them to do. And so you have this map of what to do about it. Are you frustrated that more therapists aren't using this set of tools?
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use LelaQ for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Are you frustrated that more therapists aren't using this set of tools?
No, it's gotten better.
It's gotten better?
Well, I think what frustrates me is that the people who are very carefully clinically trained do this on their own. They get ongoing supervision. They learn, they're always learning new things. But then what happened about 15, 20 years ago is that to make insurance cheaper, make treatment cheaper, they took the people now not with PhDs but with master's levels, and they got them all licensed across many states. So now they've watered down the credentials so that they get cheap therapy. And that's what we're paying for now. Mm-hmm. So really, the good therapists, who are a smaller number, we can't discriminate anymore. The general public doesn't tell the difference.
Well, help listeners know, how do you, other than going to your website, it's attachmentproject.com. You have a list of people that you certainly have looked at. How would a lay person know? All right, I've got someone who's really seriously...
Get a consultation. Go to a senior therapist who's got really good credentials and get an opinion from him about who to see and what to focus on.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so even if you have to travel a little bit or do something remote, but find someone who's incredibly well-credentialed and say, look at these people I'm thinking of going to and sort of get a referral out, or...
Let them do the intake and focus on what the map is, somebody who knows how to do this stuff. And they'll say, this is the person you should see and this is the approach you should take.
Man, I wish I had done that. The idea of getting a map to know what type of therapist to see is really cool and really useful. So thank you for offering that to people listening.
And any city, there are well-known therapists, well-credentialed, everybody knows who they are.
Okay.
Go to one of the senior people and then ask them for an hour just to do a diagnosis and intake. And then match you with somebody. That's the best way to do it. Trust their seniority.
That is so smart. Just getting the right diagnosis. I really wish I had known that when I was doing all of my work, because what a lot of people end up doing is they're looking at cost, insurability, or they're sort of stumbling around. But even if you do pay out of pocket for 1 hour of someone's time to help you know what type of person to go to that it may be in plan, that can make a big difference. Or maybe it's out of plan and you do that instead of alcohol for a while or whatever else, but you make it work because short period of time, relatively short, year isn't that short, but it's not that long either. And man, the difference in freedom that comes from knowing who you are and having self-agency and being able to have healthy relationships is life-changing. But what percentage of people do you think it takes, having done this kind of work, having their attachments healthy, does it take to sort of shift the nature of society? You mentioned there's so many narcissists running around today. The world seems pretty crazy. Do we need 20% of the world to be self-attached for things to shift?
Well, I teach a course on leadership. I teach a course, I have three versions of it. I teach a course on performance excellence for surgeons and primary care docs at the medical school, which I've done for 30 years. Another version of that I teach for judges. I've done most of the judges in Massachusetts, the Superior Court judges, the District Court judges, and the Family Court judges. I have a third version of that for executives that I teach all around the world. So the issue of how we train leaders is important to me. I think we need to train leaders who are psychologically mature, who are not self-absorbed in themselves, and they can see the larger vision in life and lead us in a positive direction for the sake of not their own self-importance, for the sake of the larger vision in life. Most people who are leaders operate out of a larger vision in life, maybe a spiritual vision or some sort of large civic vision of life. But there's a lot of research on developing a larger vision in life, and that's important.
So it's a leadership issue then, getting our leaders to do this work. Yeah. Would you encourage senior executive teams at larger companies to actually pay for their executives to go do this kind of work?
Yes, because I used to work as a consultant for a large multinational company, international company. I had seven large companies. I won't mention the name of it.
Sure.
But it was helpful to him. Because if he hires somebody to put in one of his parent companies, that's a lot of money. I remember a story where he was hiring somebody he really liked a lot, and the guy was a mover and shaker, but nobody else liked this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was a prisoner of war in the Korean War, And they didn't want to know how fragile he was because he talked about his prisoner of war background. But he was definitely moved things. So I did an evaluation on this guy. He flagged all the self-reports fails. So I said to the head of this company, I said, I don't hate to bust your bubble here, but I don't think this guy's telling the truth. I think he's fabricated a whole story about his life.
Wow.
And he looked into it with private investigator. He said, you know, you're right. He didn't have a military history. He was never a prisoner of war. Thank you. You saved us a lot of money here.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
I ran into that early in my career. We had a guy who claimed he had actually the same thing. He was a special forces or Navy SEAL or something like that at a senior position in a company. And it was just not true. And I found out and I'm 25. I'm like, what do I do? This guy's like 10 layers up in the org. But with my sense of justice and all, I flagged the issue confidentially and with a couple of trusted members of the executive team and said, like, I know this to be true because I work in computer security and computer security people know these things. It actually happens. People completely...
It took a certain courage on your part to persist with that.
I didn't get fired for it, but he didn't get fired either, which was a sign that our leadership was not healthy.
I really respect what you did with that.
Thank you. I was frankly scared shitless, but it was the right thing to do.
But you persisted. Yeah. It was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Most people won't do that.
Yeah.
Deeply appreciate that.
Thanks. I'm not sure what motivated me to do that. Thinking back on it.
Because it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. So I'll go with that. There was probably some ego in there too. Like, you know, that's not right. But it was a sense of justice and it was the right thing to do. I am with you there in that I believe that it is worth it for senior executives in companies, you know, to help support each other and to help support leadership. But in this case, if you were hired to do work or to do an analysis of this guy, how does that work with HIPAA and disclosures? I mean, did the guy agree that he'd work with you and that he'd share with the boss?
Yeah, I get that up front. I get those agreements up front, otherwise I won't do the work.
So you just have him sign a contract that says, yeah, you can talk with Dan and whatever you share is fair game kind of a thing.
That's what I do.
Okay. Very cool.
It's part of informed consent. Best informed consent is transparency.
Yes, 100%. I really like that. And I do believe in investing in that. If you have someone who's great at what they do and they're, you know, leaving bodies everywhere they go at work, either you fire them or you help them get better. And if it's one of these problems and it's an hour of diagnosis, if they're committed to doing the work, you work with them on doing the work, if they have the courage.
One of my colleagues, and we did some of his research together, was David McClellan when he was at Harvard. He's now deceased, but he did work on motivation. He said there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who are power motivated and those who are affiliatory motivated. Mm. And the affiliatory motivated people are not interested in power. They don't take positions of leadership, but they should. People who are interested in power are totally insensitive to other people's needs, but they like to be in positions of power. So we always select the wrong people. We should take affiliatory people and train them to be leaders. Because we know by they will be being hard and then they're going to be much better and more sensitive to leaders. But we always select people who are power motivated and it doesn't work very well.
I've heard of some smaller tribes in Africa who would select their leadership that way, where the people would select the person who least wanted to be the leader because they were the most affiliatory. And the people who really wanted to be leader, like, no, you're going to lead us in the wrong way. We don't want a power monger there.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I always approve of that because it just feels sort of bad. Someone who really wants that. Well, why do you want that? I can't imagine a worse job than being president. but maybe that's just me.
I ran two departments at the medical school in the 1980s, and I hated it because I wasn't power motivated. Never liked the job, but people felt that I treated them well under them.
Yeah,
and they could be different from me, and they could disagree with me, and that was perfectly fine.
I bet they liked it, even if you didn't. And I think that may be the inherent problem. Well, I'm not sure which of those two spectrums I fall in. I pretty much don't care greatly for the power of leadership, but I think it's important to create an organization of good people who can do can do good work. But that means I have to hire people who are good at the power thing to help manage all that. Otherwise, it becomes a little too much for me.
You want to do an exercise, right?
Yeah, let's do an exercise about the best self-visualization. I really want people who listen to this to get just a drop of the feeling, or maybe more than a drop of what we're talking about.
Okay, so settle back into your chair.
All right. And by the way, if people are going to participate along with this, I'm assuming they need to not be driving.
Tune out the world so you can't be driving, no.
Okay, good deal. So if you're listening to the show while you're driving or something, or at the gym or something, you probably want to save the rest of this episode for when you can sit down in a quiet place. All right, I'm gonna go first. Tell me what to do again.
Settle back and focus on your breathing. Just observe the natural rhythm of your breathing. And when you breathe in, the eyes will open. When you breathe out, the eyes will close. And just get really reduced to that now. Completely absorbed in the rhythm of your breathing. And tuning out all the distractions, just focusing on the breathing. And now, when you breathe out, put a little more emphasis on the exhalation. See if you make each successive out-breath a little bit longer, a little bit slower than the previous one. Just a little bit. As you begin to slow down an out-breath, you get increasingly calm and relaxed. And at some point, it was perfectly natural to keep the eyes closed and focus more inward. And when you focus more inward, you become even more calm and relaxed. Completely absorbed in that calm, relaxed state. Focused without distraction. And while you're in this focused, relaxed state, free of distraction, bring to mind the time in your life that you felt you operate out of your best and strongest sense of self. A time when you brought your best self to whatever you were doing at the time. Let's revisit that in your memory right now. And the more you reflect on this scene, the more you'll generate that feeling of that best self, that strong sense of self, right now, once again. So soon you begin to really feel it. Feeling it more clearly and more intensely, the more you focus on it. You notice that it comes with a backdrop of a good feeling. The best and stronger sense of self. And the more you hold this in your awareness continuously, the more you see that there are certain qualities you associate with this best self. And you can give voice to those qualities. Silently to yourself. As you identify each and every one of them. But most people can identify 3, 4, 5 qualities associated with their best sense of self. So begin to do that now. Your best, strongest, most independent sense of self. And the more you reflect on this, you'll identify certain characteristics of that best self. And these will become more and more familiar to you the more you reflect on them. So see if you can identify 3, 4, 5 of these qualities, the best self. Soon the scene's going to change. You're going to imagine something in your current life that's important to you. And you're going to imagine bringing that best sense of self right into that situation. So you operate out of that best self in that situation. So now imagine the scene where you bring that best sense of self into this current situation. Notice how that changes everything about your experience about that situation. Notice how your best self approaches this, but your ordinary self doesn't. Familiarize yourself with the best sense of self in this situation and all the influence that that has. How different that is from your usual sense of self, your ordinary sense of self. Now the scene's going to change again. Next thing, imagine yourself at some time in the future, a time in the future when you develop this best sense of self, so it's even stronger and more independent. And you've fleshed out all the qualities of that best self, even more than you have done today. Imagine a scene where you operate on that best sense of self in the future. Notice how it affects everything in your life. So now create a scene. You operate on that best and stronger sense of self in all the ways that you can. Get a taste for what that feels like. Hold that sense of self clearly in your awareness. Make a deep imprint of it in your mind. So you hold this as a vision that you can do grow and develop into. Now let it go and relax. I'm going to count from 5 to 1. You can awaken yourself. At which one, you'll be fully awake and settled with your experience. Beginning to awaken now. 5, 4, waking up more and more. 3, 2, 1, fully awake and settled with your experience. So it's rather simple visualization. You imagine some situation. We operate on the best sense of self, and most people can readily identify that. Maybe a golf game, maybe a tennis game, maybe something you did civically with some group, maybe some teaching that you did, whatever. And then you transfer it to the current situation. We want to bring that best sense of self into the situation. This is an exercise that I did with the judges. That is one of the favorite ones. They might have be really on the game in golf or tennis, but they bring that state of mind onto the bench. They're much more present. They don't get bored as much. So I imagine them bringing their best sense of self into the courtroom more and rehearsing that and developing it over time. And they don't get so bored and they do a better job with being on the bench.
That makes so much sense. It's funny you mentioned teaching, because that I've learned when I'm doing this kind of work, I always, you go with the first thing that flashes into your head, even if it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because your unconscious throws that up there for a reason. So I hadn't thought of it in a long time, but the first time I got a standing ovation at the end of teaching a class at the University of California, which is a great honor as a teacher, when your class is like, oh, is that good? That, all right, I'm there. So that was what popped into my head. And you mentioned teaching as one of the things. So there you go. You must be psychic on top of everything else. You know, that you've been doing this for a while. Now, this is an example of the kind of things that you can do in a therapeutic session. And I think there are some things you can do when you're... things you can do with audio files and various things online. Is that something that you do with the attachment project? I mean, are there Dan Brown audio files you can listen to you guiding people through this?
There's a lot of them on the website. We're putting everything on the website.
Got it.
I did a 2-day course on performance excellence, and I have a 7-day immersion course for executives.
Well, these are courses.
But they're mostly structured visualizations. So you can do the whole set of them. We try to take the best of emotional growth and put it on, and translate it out of the office and put it on the website where people can actually do the exercises.
I think that's really powerful in terms of doing a course and just doing the exercises separately. And maybe that's just built into the courses. After our first interview, I was so impressed. And I said, we've got to do a second one. I asked your team if you guys would do a discount for Bulletproof Radio listeners, and you kindly said yes. So 20% off the online course at attachmentproject.com. Go attachmentproject.com/Dave. Because I think this is really worthy, and it's worth your time if you're thinking about what should I do while I still have time at home, or what should I do even if I'm really busy? Attachmentproject.com/Dave, and just use the code Dave. And if you have any of the things we've talked about now, and newsflash, if you're alive and you haven't done a lot of personal development work, I promise you, you do. I know that I had a whole bunch of these things going on in my life. And I think I've succeeded in many of them. And there's still other ones where it's a continuous process of growth. So I'll tell you, if you've never done any kind of personal development stuff, you need to get going on that. And you need to get going on it because you'll be happier and you'll like your life better. But more importantly, everyone around you will like it as well too. So it's your impact on the world changes when you do the work.
I'm trying to take about 50 years of what we learned in psychology and put it on the practical exercise that people would do in terms of structured visualizations.
In fact, that's the best way to put it. You guys all know the ROI, the return on investment for the show. My deal with you is if you don't get more out of Bulletproof Radio, the hour or so you've been listening, than an hour's worth of time and value, you should unsubscribe. You should stop listening. And I mean that same thing. Don't go to my blog if it's not worth your time, because I'd rather do something that's more useful. So same thing here. You want 50 years of knowledge and sorting out all this stuff compressed into a very short period of time. It's a very high ROI on those courses. And the same thing if you decide to read one of Dan's books, one that's appealing to you. Same thing. It takes a very long time to write a book and a very short time to get the knowledge out. So in terms of you becoming enriched, that's how I'd recommend you do it. And Dan, I want to thank you for walking me through that exercise and for sharing it with listeners. And guys, that discount code is just there for you to save money. There's no financial arrangement or anything like that. It's just because it's worthy. And I think you're worth the time to listen to this episode and to create this episode. I think you're worth the time to go out and do the work. And I just really appreciate you, appreciate your work, and thank you.
You're a really good skill interview. I really enjoyed being with you.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.